Hello and warm welcome to Centre Stage. Good to have you with us. I have the pleasure of standing in for my colleague, your regular host, Bahadur Bijani, for a couple of weeks. The Iranian diplomatic mission in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, was the target of two suicide bombers last week. The attack left dozens of people either killed or wounded. In our show tonight, we'll try to see why a target the Iranian embassy and see who stands to gain if Lebanon were to become the center stage again. Stay with us. Welcome back. Tonight, we are delighted to be joined here in our Tehran studio by Mohammad Hassan Khani, Professor of Political Science and International Relations at Imam Sadegh University in Tehran. Professor Khani, thank you for joining us, sir.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours, sir. Okay, time for a short break for our narration. Stay with us.
Over 2 dozen people have been killed and another 150 injured in two bomb explosions outside the Iranian embassy in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. The bombings were carried out on November 19th in Beirut's southern neighborhood of Jinnah. The first explosion occurred when a bomber blew his explosives near the gate of the embassy, and the second blast happened just meters away when a car bomb went off. Lebanon's caretaker Prime Minister Najib Mikati described the bombings as a cowardly terrorist act. Mikati told reporters that the aim of the attacks was to stir up the situation in Lebanon. An Al-Qaeda linked group, Abdullah Azzam Brigades, has claimed responsibility for the twin bombings. Following the attacks, the United Nations Security Council and the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon issued statements and strongly condemned the blasts. Iranian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Marzia Afram has accused the Israeli regime of being behind the deadly terrorist bombings. She strongly condemned the twin blasts and said the move was an inhumane crime and a spiteful measure by the Zionist Israeli regime and its mercenaries.
Welcome back. Professor Khani, without further ado, sir, your thoughts on the attack on the Iranian mission in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Why target the Iranian embassy, sir?
Well, there are many different factors involved. In any kind of terrorism, first of all, it's not new for Lebanon to witness such a thing. I mean, during the past decade or so, especially during the 80s and 90s, Lebanon has been the scene of these kind of terrorist activities and clash between different factions, which was called a civil war. That's rightly. The balance of power in domestic politics of Lebanon somehow changed when Hezbollah emerged as a very, very strong player, both militarily and politically. And the emergence of Hezbollah somehow led to the decline of other groups. So what I want to say here is the fact that the more powerful Hezbollah means the more security and stability that has been a fact on the ground. The more powerful Hezbollah has somehow contributed to more security and stability in Lebanon.
And therefore more prosperity for the country.
Exactly. So that's why the majority of Lebanese, even Christians, they are happy to see that Hezbollah has been there bringing some kind of pride, dignity and security and stability and economic prosperity for their country.
That's right.
But unfortunately, the internal fight somehow is not the only factor when we are talking about Lebanon. Lebanon.
What other factors come into play?
Yes, the other factors includes many regional players and the player beyond coming from beyond the region. One of the turning points in Lebanon's politics has been the war between Hezbollah and Israel. Mm-hmm. So again, when Hezbollah emerged as somehow victorious from that war, that consolidated the position of Hezbollah in Lebanon and to some extent beyond the borders of Lebanon, and turned Hezbollah into not only a player in domestic politics of Lebanon, but it's just turned Hezbollah to a regional player.
To be reckoned with.
Exactly. And that was a turning point in my view. There were many regional powers, including Saudi Arabia and many sheikhdoms in the Persian Gulf region, and also in the other Arab capitals, who were not happy to see that. Mm-hmm. So we are now, after that big event, we witnessed some kind of unofficial alliance between these Arab countries, mm-hmm. and United States and Israel. So we are talking about the triangle of alliances between different external factors.
Targeting the axis of resistance. In
exactly.
A sense.
And then came the Syrian issue. So you see that the equation is being more complicated. When the Syrian crisis came, again, both opponents of Hezbollah in Lebanon and the external players, they wish somehow to see a decline of Hezbollah due to the pressure on Bashar Assad in Damascus. And they were hopeful and wishful that sooner or later, Bashar Assad will fall and this resistance axis will be broken.
Right.
In that sense, they were somehow investing too much to make sure that will happen. But it didn't. And we all know that in spite of all pressure coming toward Damascus, Bashar Assad is still there and now gradually gaining lost ground. Yes, from the opposition groups and from the Takfiris and Salafis who are fighting mm-hmm. inside Lebanon. It is now a fact recognized by many, many players, even Turkey, that those who are fighting against Bashar Assad are not just the Syrian opposition. Maybe the main part is coming from outside. I mean, the fighters coming from different Arab countries.
The financial sponsorship.
Being supported by Saudi Arabia money,
Qatar,
other Arab countries. And it seems that Turkey is the first country that somehow is noticing the fact and distancing. It's
that
very likely.
That they've gambled on the wrong horse,
exactly,
in a sense.
Exactly. It's very likely, in my view, that we see in near future somehow again a turning point from the Turkish position. If that happens, if Iran and Turkey could again align with each other and play with each other in a much broader game, that could be somehow maybe a turning point in the Syrian scene and the Syrian equation of power when it comes to the region and Lebanon and Syria itself.
So in a sense, what you're saying, Professor Khani, this attempt could be interpreted as an attempt to tilt the balance of power against the Hezbollah and in favor of the enemies of Hezbollah in Lebanon.
That's
and
the case.
The axis of resistance.
Exactly. And now targeting the core of this axis, which is Iran. I mean, it's not accidental that they somehow chose the Iranian embassy neighborhood mm-hmm. to do that. It was maybe they were sending a message to Tehran that, okay, the support for Hezbollah and the Iranian position somehow is something that we respond to violently, even by act of terrorism. From terrorist groups such as Salafis and Wahhabis, it's not something new or strange, but something that somehow strikes me that how nation states, governments, such as Saudi Arabia, are not in a position to condemn straightforward these kind of activities.
Such callous attacks.
Yes, and distance themselves from these groups. Even, I mean, maybe not behind the scene. I mean, they could just come out and somehow on the surface try to condemn it. And it's very strange and it's very difficult to understand that what will be the ultimate gain for countries like this. Because at the end of the day, we are neighbors. I mean, mm-hmm. Saudis should come to terms that, like it or not, we have to live together. And sooner or later, maybe we start negotiating. So it's very difficult to somehow understand and analyze that what's going on deeply in the mind of the Saudis. Maybe, again, the Israeli factor here is very important. I mean, unfortunately, Americans and Saudi and Israelis have succeeded in their effort to somehow propagate a kind of Iranophobia across the region, and especially in Saudi Arabia. That could be maybe the sole explanation that why Saudi are so fearful. I mean, if you ask them, what's going on? I mean, what's wrong with you? And why you cannot, I mean, behave in a way that could approach Iran and share your concerns. So this is the natural mm-hmm. path if there is a difference. If there is a rivalry, I mean, there are so many other countries in the world that are rivals,
that's right.
but they do not act in this way against
that's
each other,
right.
you know?
That's right.
Rivalry has its own logic. And I hope that our friends and our neighbors in Arab countries could understand that and come to terms with such a behavioral approach that could be logical and similar to the other rivals across the globe. So they have, they can adopt a competition when there is rivalry and cooperation where there are common interests. And you know, the lines of common interest between Iran and countries like this is the stability and security in the whole region.
That's right.
In the Middle East as a whole and in the Persian Gulf specifically. So there are, in my view, still, in spite of all difficulties that we had with our Arab neighbors and especially Saudi Arabia in this case, I do believe that there are still areas of common interest between two sides.
Definitely.
Upon which we can agree on and avoid any further events like this.
Friction. Thank you. Well, it's time for us to take a short break. Don't go away. Welcome back to Center Stage. Professor Khani, why is it that some groups, some capitals, regional capitals as it were, are seeking to make Lebanon the center stage once again? Are they, can they afford to pay the price, the high price, if Lebanon were to become unstable?
Well, when we ask why, I mean, it's clear that Lebanon, as I said, has played a very important role in the past two decades in the region and in the making or breaking the balance of power in the Middle Eastern politics. Mm-hmm. That's why Lebanon is still and again the center stage. But whether or not they will succeed, it's I mean a matter of time. But there are signs that can convince us that it's not going to happen. I mean, if Hezbollah was weak, if Iran was not willing to somehow go ahead and continue its policy towards Lebanon and its whole policy in the Middle East, if Iran was somehow shaky, that could be the case. But there are no such signs indicating that these two players, Iran and Hezbollah, are in a position to change their view or to change their long-term strategic perspective mm-hmm. on the Middle East, and Hezbollah, as far as Hezbollah is concerned, in its policy towards Israel or its role in domestic politics of Lebanon. So it seems that everything will go on as it has been in the past. It's very difficult to imagine a scenario that these kind of acts of terrorism could somehow affect both Hezbollah's or Iranian policy.
Thank you. First of all, the terror attacks happened the day before the Geneva meeting between Iran and the P5 plus one, which led to the breakthrough nuclear deal between the parties. Do you see any connection between these two events? Because even prior to the Geneva meeting, there was this air of optimism that a deal was
very likely to
be achieved.
There could be connections. Again, it comes back to Iran and its role in the Middle East, and the concerns or worries by some capitals in the region. Before the Geneva talks, the last round that led to a breakthrough, we had been hearing voices of concerns, not only from Tel Aviv, but also from Riyadh. And it was not a secret. Saudi politicians and Saudi security officials have been somehow talking loudly, complaining about the possibility of an agreement in Geneva. And that was somehow an irony and a surprise for many observers to see that it was so deep that many analysts called it an unholy alliance between Riyadh and Tel Aviv, something somehow unthinkable in the past few years. But it happened. So what happened in Beirut could be, again, a sign of a very deep worry or unhappy player somehow trying to show its anger or its protest, what is going on. But what happened in Geneva, again, demonstrated that Iranian foreign policy is somehow moving forward, is finding its foot on the ground. And somehow it was, as many others said, an achievement for Iran to make sure that it could go ahead and make an agreement by which it could safeguard the Iranian national interests, and also to bring that very, maybe a long decade stalemate of mm-hmm. the negotiation about Iranian nuclear issue to an end.
Right. Professor Ghani, what do you see as the connection between the gains being made, significant gains being made by the Syrian army on the ground, winning back a lot of the lost ground, and that the fact that these the sponsors of terrorism, the sponsors and the Takfiri groups are realizing that that their dreams are not going to become true, are not going to become true in Syria, taking out their anger on the Lebanese people and on Hezbollah and Iran, for example.
This is perhaps the most important connection. The connection between the Syrian developments, as I said, mm-hmm. and what happened in Beirut. I'm sure that those who committed this act are surely part of those groups who are now fighting in Syria against Bashar Assad. So, as I said, as we are witnessing the gains by the Syrian governments on the ground, they were so much in such a desperate to go ahead and revenge from Hezbollah on Lebanese soil. So it is very likely, this connection, it makes sense that we believe that it was somehow a reaction or a revenge from the Takfiri groups who were somehow be defeated by Syrian army in Syrian territory. Now, the security between Syrian borders and Lebanon, as all we know, are very fragile. So it's very likely and very possible for these groups to come and go across the border. It seems that, yes, they are fighting now in two fronts. The first front and the official front is the Syrian soil. And the other front is inside Lebanon, where they could somehow do such a terrible thing.
Thank you. Professor Khani, can you shed some light on the agenda pursued by the Takfiris? What is this Takfiri project which has come to the fore in recent years? What are they after?
Well, it's very difficult to explain the agenda. First of all, because we are not talking about a very specific official player, such as nation state, or a very somehow recognized organization with an ID. So this is the big difference between these groups and groups and organizations such as Hezbollah, even Hamas, you know.
Belong to the nation
are,
state.
Yes, these groups, such as Hezbollah or Hamas, they are very well-known organizations. You know the leadership, you know the structure, you know the bases, you know the headquarters, although they are not nation states. But they are identified players, well-known players inside a nation, and even when you look at them at the regional player, they have the address. You know what I mean?
That's right.
But these groups, these Salafi and Takfiri groups, are somehow unknown identities or entities.
That's right.
Nobody knows exactly who is the leader, what is their agenda, what is their specific manifestation, or somehow what is their specific agenda for political, when it comes to political issues. So everything is in a darkness and somehow under shadow. That's the fact that makes them very dangerous. Takfiri and Salafis somehow can be seen as players used by Saudi Arabia.
Right.
To follow its regional policy. And this is, again, at the beginning of my statement, I mentioned somehow my surprise that how Saudis, as a nation state, are committing such an act, I mean, and making such a mistake. You know, maybe a comparison can help the viewers and you to understand the nature of these groups. We are talking about groups that have been engineered or organized by outside players, being financed and then equipped with the weapon. And we are not talking about one specific ethnic groups or even
nationalities
coming from different nationalities, different parts of the world. So maybe the one cause brought them together. Some kind of fanaticism is maybe the common line for these groups. It's very similar to what happened in Afghanistan during the Soviet occupation.
That's right.
You know, we were somehow, we had a number of different groups coming from different nationalities fighting there. And then they somehow ended up in turning against their supporters.
That's right.
They have been used as a tool, as a means, but somehow
they got out of control.
Yes, they somehow orchestrated a coup and turned against. It's very likely that we see these kind of things again when it comes to Salafis and Wahhabis, and sooner or later, the supporters of these people and these groups are going to pay the price. And again, as I mentioned, I think Turkey somehow has been clever to have this feeling.
I was going to ask, is this one of the reasons that that Ankara is somehow distancing itself from
crisis? Exactly. This is my feeling, that Turkish politicians were smart enough to understand the danger coming from within these groups that Ankara has been supporting. So in that sense, maybe Turkey is the first one to understand that and distancing. I hope sooner or later the other countries in the region
would realize
somehow
the repercussions.
Acknowledge this dangerous fact and somehow react responsibly to the issue.
Thank you. Professor Khan, you referred to the nuclear deal having been struck in Geneva between Iran and the P5 plus one. Can I have your thoughts on that deal? Who are the winners? Who are the losers, if we can put them as such?
Well, in the past few days, there have been different analyses and different comments. We can talk about three different views. The first view, which seems to be a balanced one, is somehow talking about a win-win scenario. Iran has somehow gained some points and also somehow offered a lot of points to the other side when it comes to confidence building measures.
Right.
But there are those who believe that the Western countries, P5+1, they somehow are the winner and Iran is the loser. And there are those, I mean, interestingly, I've read in the news today and yesterday, there were comments and articles in op-ed, in editorial parts of many different newspapers in the Western capital, including the United States, blaming Obama for making a big mistake, talking about the loophole in the deal, in the text, talking about a catastrophe for U.S. foreign policy. So,
and having the Iran nuclear program intact.
Exactly. These are the reasons that they brought. So in that sense, we are talking about a number of different perspectives from which they are looking at the issue.
Who has the stronger argument in their
In my view,
analysis?
The first one, I mean, the scenario which says that, okay, the deal is balanced, and there is a win-win somehow points in that. And I would like to elaborate a little bit about it. You know, when you look at the agreement, first of all, it's the good news about it is the fact that finally, after more than a decade of a stalemate and That's deadlock, true. Both sides, Iran and the 5+1, they managed to make a deal.
Finally.
This is very important. The fact that they managed to make a deal and to come out and say, okay, we did something. We achieved something. It was an achievement for the sake of the agreement itself. Point number two is the fact that the Western countries who were worried and concerned and always complaining about the lack of confidence on the Iranian side. Now they could somehow convince Iranian to make these confidence building measures or to accept them. That is something that could be a capital for both sides to build upon the next phases of the agreements.
Right.
And from Iranian view, well, of course, Iran somehow agreed to halt the enrichment up to 20% enrichment. But we know that according to agreement, the Iranian infrastructure, the nuclear technology infrastructure, and it remains intact. So that means the West knows the red line of the Iranians.
That's right.
And somehow, so far, it respected that red line, saying that, implying that, okay, we respect the Iranian right to nuclear technology. Of course, there are differences about what is this right exactly. Because according to the Iranian interpretation of the NPT, which is, in my view, very clear, Iran has every right to enrich uranium in its soils and have the technology without any doubt. So in that sense, when we are talking about NPT, let me quote the Article 4, which is talking about, and I quote, inalienable right of every country who signed the treaty, NPT. Right to what? According to NPT, Article 4, right to develop, to produce, to use, and to research nuclear technology. So it's very clear that enrichment is part of this process.
Right.
So you cannot exclude.
Enshrined in the NPT.
It's definitely, you know, to develop nuclear peaceful technology, you need to have or to somehow achieve different parts in order to do that. You must be able to make centrifuges. You must be able to make the site. You must be able to
maintain
enrich
them.
Uranium.
That's right.
So these are ingredients or components of the technology.
Okay.
It's very clear that you cannot exclude it. It is funny that how Americans, under the pressure, obvious pressure coming from Tel Aviv, somehow starting to say that, okay, enrichment is not a right, there is no such a word in, I mean, it is childish. I mean, everybody who knows the alphabets of legal texts in international law, agrees that this is something that has been mentioned in the NPT. So in that sense, when we're talking about the balance in the agreement, if the Iranian structure remains there and the West recognizes Iranian right to have to enrich uranium on its soil up to, well, between 3 or 5%. So in that sense, I think Iran has not lost any significant thing to the other side.
Thank you, Professor Khani. We're going to take another short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Center Stage. Professor Khani, why did Tel Aviv, the Zionist regime, call this the mistake of a century? And why did we witness this deafening silence coming out of Riyadh for the first couple of days after the deal having been struck in Geneva?
Well, there could be a different explanation for each side. And we have to distinguish between Saudi Arabia and Israel. It is a very difficult job for Iran to talk to Saudis and to convince them that Iran is not a threat. We are friendly neighbors. We have diplomatic relations, and in the past we enjoyed a very good degree of cordial relationship between,
that's
even
right.
After the revolution and in the past decade,
right.
We have been enjoying a good friendship between the two sides. So it is a tough job, but it is possible in my view. And I think maybe after the disagreement, it would be very important and vital for Iranian foreign policy to approach or adapt a policy somehow to convince our Arab neighbors, including Saudi Arabia, talking to them. I wonder why we do not have a routine contact between Riyadh and Tehran, trips from diplomats on the other side, on the high level, low level, talking to each other, hotline. So we have to distinguish these two cases. They are totally different.
Mm-hmm.
We can convince Saudis that Iran is not a threat, And Iranian peaceful technology is just for peaceful purposes. It is a scientific achievement. And we can somehow cope with each other in spite of all the political differences that we have. This is point number one. But the Israeli issue is something else. You know, Israelis are very hostile to Iran. I mean, in spite of all criticism about Iran and Iranian rhetoric against Israel, it has been the other side. It has been Tel Aviv that had been in the past decade repeatedly talking about striking Iran, attacking Iran or without United States. This is the literature of the Israeli leaders in the past few years. So Israel is totally different. And it is understandable that why Israel doesn't want this agreement to go on. Because what is ideal for Israel is somehow the weakness of Iran, the collapse of the Islamic Republic, if possible, in their view. And if not, to have an isolated Iran, a very weak economy, and somehow a very weak country militarily. So that's why Israeli Prime Minister is always talking about dismantling the Iranian nuclear technology rather than somehow confidence building measures.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened in Geneva was a step towards confidence building measures and keeping the Iranian nuclear technology and respecting the Iranian right. So that shows why Israelis are so angry about it and somehow shouting towards the West and the Obama administration saying that it is a bad deal, it is a very bad deal. So what's the good deal for them? The good deal is dismantling Iranian nuclear technology totally, which is impossible. I mean, everybody knows, even the Western diplomats know that it's not going to happen. But Israeli are just following this path, and they hope that they can influence different capitals from Washington, D.C. to Paris to London, putting pressure on them to somehow make the deal as much as possible in favor of Israel and to somehow put more pressure on Iran. I don't think that this policy is going to achieve, but it is a challenge, I have to say. It is maybe the biggest challenge that this agreement is facing. If Israelis manage to continue this pressure, so it's not a surprise that we see again, because we have the experience in the past that the West and the United States giving up under pressure of Israelis and the lobby, Israeli lobby, IPAC, I mean, they are now very active to somehow sabotage the path of the agreement.
Thank you. Well, on that note, we've come to the end of this edition of Center Stage. Special thanks to our studio guest, Mohammad Hassan Khani, Professor of Political Science and International Relations at Imam Sadegh University in Tehran. Professor Khani, thank you for having come on our program, sir.
Thank you for having me.
It was a pleasure. And that's a wrap for tonight's edition. I'd like to thank our viewers for staying tuned. Goodbye and God bless.